All right, well, proving God's existence, how does our classical brothers do this? Well, disproving non-theistic worldviews and philosophies of life does not necessarily prove theism, right? So you knock down all the pins and you're like, there, we're the only ones standing. Well, hold on, that might be the case, but how are we certain that there's not some other 11th pin in this frame and we're not able to knock this down? We can't just assume that you've knocked them all down. Well, classic apologists therefore offer a variety of arguments to support theism. In brief, four major arguments for God's existence have dominated the classical apologetics. First is the ontological argument, and the second and third are known as the cosmological and the teleological arguments. And the fourth major theistic argument emerged in modern times and is the moral argument.
All right, yeah, so those four. So notice classical apologists are careful, though, to issue certain caveats about the use of theistic proofs. One such caveat is that the theistic arguments, as they are popularly understood, are often invalid. That is that, they need to be formulated carefully and rigorously if they are to be valid. Second, most people actually, do not need to hear theistic arguments since they are not atheists, right? What they need is evidence that God is the kind of God found in Scripture. And so what we'll take a look at here is three of the four major theistic arguments in this particular chapter and focus on how their classical formulation as philosophical proofs for God's existence work. And then our authors want to change, put off the teleological argument and discuss that in chapter 10.
Right. All right, well, we start with the always fun one, the moral argument. Well, the moral argument relates to the universality of moral experience and holds that unless there is a God, there's no ultimate basis for moral law. If you've seen William Lane Craig argue before, this is a favor of his, and so you might not think that from his writing, but this tends to be one where he really harps on or makes the other side focus on more and more because he doesn't believe that there is an ultimate basis for morality if there's no standard moral giver. Well, classical apologists answered the objection that ethical judgments vary from place to place by arguing that regardless of time or culture, there is a built-in concept of normative conduct, a universal sense of ought and should. So, when you ask a consistent atheist, why ought you do something, then the consistent atheist should say, well, there's no ought, but there is a it would be nice or it would work out for the best as far as an ends to a means. We hope. Hope might not be within their desired vocabulary, but a longing for an outward expectation there.
Yeah, right. So notice, it is true that people can acknowledge the moral law without seeing that, the moral law as a theistic proof, but this does not mean that such a law could have real validity, says the classicalist, right, apart from God. So the real thrust of this argument lies in the fact that when people express approval or criticism of the actions of others, they are behaving as if theism were true. That is, as if there are such things as absolute rights and wrong. And so classical apologists typically argue that one would have to assume this position in order to criticize it as wrong. So notice, as you mentioned, this kind of approach, this moral argument kind of strikes me as really close to a presuppositional approach, right? Really, what you're asking is, what has to be the case for morality to be meaningful? Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a transcendental question, right? That's the kind of questions that presuppositionalists ask about rationality, morality, logic, all kinds of things. And so, this argument, even if when it's used by classicalists, always strikes me as a kind of a presuppositional approach to argue.
Right. Yeah. Watch any YouTube video where Turek is talking to college students and talking about this. It's always, how can you say that is wrong? By what's, we don't want to say by what standard, because that might make us go look elsewhere. But that seems Like it's the one potato in the barrel of apples there. Just right. Feels like it's a little bit off from you know, the cosmological argument there.
Right. And oftentimes this argument is confused because people take this argument often as saying, so are you saying that an atheist cannot be moral? And right. That's not what the argument is saying.
Right.
The argument is saying the atheist has no grounds for morality.
Right.
In other words, you know, he can't really give us a good answer to the question, what has to be the case for morality to be meaningful? Mm-hmm. Right. So he doesn't have a ground. So it's not that, you know, people that don't believe in God can't be moral. Yeah, they can not lie and that sort of thing. But why? Right. And what is the grounds for that? How do you, you know, what's the justification for that? Well, right. I just, you know, human, you know, flourishing. Well, why is that such a big deal? Why? Right. You know,
yeah.
Why not? I don't know. Ant flourishing.
Yeah, you know? or just a me flourishing.
Yeah, really.
I don't care what happens after my you know 70 years, but I want all the stuff before I die. So there we go. That's how yeah. You know who wins, right? Yeah. Well, and that I mean that's the early parts of Romans. I mean you have Romans 2 and 3 talking about this. You know, even the Gentiles hold themselves up to a standard, but They even fall under its own weight. And also then, why do they hold themselves to the standard? And so that's part of Paul's early introduction of this all men knowing type deal.
Yeah.